TD and Production Nuit d'Afrique present Women of the World Raise Their Voices, 5 special concert evenings from February 1st to March 8th. Don't miss the grand premiere. Lidl's Cameroonian Slam, Brazilian songwriter Bia Ferreira, Lorraine Classen's 40-year career anniversary, The Roots Daughters Sound System, and Cora Virtuoso, Sona Jobarte. Discover the full program on festivalnuitafrique.com. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we get response to the International Court of Justice handing down its decision today at The Hague, we want to go right now to the State Department, the questioning of Matt Miller, State Department spokesperson, by the Associated Press reporter Matt Lee. This took place last week about Israel's demolition of Al Isra University in Gaza.
I mean, it looks like they control demolition. It looks like what we do here in this country when we're taking down an old hotel or a stadium. And you have nothing to say? You have nothing to say about this? To do that kind of an explosion, you need to be in there. You have to put the explosives down, and it takes a lot of planning and preparation to do. And if there was a threat from this particular facility, they wouldn't have been able to do it.
So I have seen the video. I can tell you that it is something we are raising with the governor of Israel, as we do often do when we to ask questions and find out what the underlying situation is, as we often do when we see reports of this nature. But I'm not able to characterize the actual facts on the ground before hearing that response.
Yeah, but you saw the video.
I did see the video. I don't know what was under that building. I don't know what was inside.
Well, yeah,
inside.
But it doesn't matter what was under the building, because they obviously got in there to put the explosives down to do it in the way that they did.
I'm glad you have factual certainty about it. I just don't. All I have is what I saw in the video.
I just don't. And I think you guys saw it too.
We did see it, and I can say that we have raised it with the government.
And it's not troubling to you?
We are always troubled by any degradation of civilian infrastructure in Gaza.
That's State Department spokesperson Matt Miller being questioned by the AP reporter Matt Lee. We're continuing our discussion and talking about facts on the ground in Gaza. We'll start with Professor Mahmoud Mamdani, professor of government at Columbia University, the School of International and Public Affairs, SIPA, specializing in the study of colonialism. You are a professor, Mamdani. Professor Mamdani, if you can talk about the response of professors here to the destruction of universities, cultural spaces in Gaza, and the significance of this, and where you think this preliminary ruling of the ICJ, how you think it will affect what's being described today?
Well, I think the more facts come to light, the more Israel's actions in Gaza look like a textbook case of genocide. This calculated destruction of a people's intellectual resources and intellectual legacy is not something which just has a short-term impact or is based on a short-term consideration. It is aimed at a long-term resolution of this question. Already, there is considerable concern amongst faculty at Columbia University. For the last few days, I've been seeing emails going around with photographs of this, what the AP reporter called controlled demolition, premeditated demolition. People are asking Columbia University to take action, to declare where they stand. And this will go on. One thing I'm struck by is sort of evidence mounts, is that the court ruling relied on two sources of information. One was UN commissions, and the second was statements by Israeli leaders themselves, nothing else. And in doing so, it followed almost strictly the South African application, because the South African application also drew its facts, not from other sources, but from UN commissions. And now we have got a situation where the court has asked Israel to report back in a month and tell the court what it has done to comply with its decision, and given South Africa the right to comment on this report back by Israel. This is going to be another round of not just PR, because this is going to be a controlled process. So I think we are on to good territory. We are on to a territory which will bring more and more facts to light. And therefore, we are on to a territory which will permit increased political mobilization based on these facts, especially in the US and Israel, because these are the two countries where there has been minimal information in the mass media on what's been going on in Gaza. Now, this will become open territory.
I want to bring in Diana Buttu again as we begin to wrap the show. Yesterday, Ryan Grimm in The Intercept wrote, "I was at the State Department briefing today and asked if the U.S. would pledge not to veto the International Court of Justice's preliminary ruling on the genocide charges against Israel." If you can respond to what that means, what this process is, and again, what's happening on the ground now in Gaza with Israel dropping more leaflets on what was a safe space, which was Khan Yunis, and this parade of humanity and misery of hundreds, if not thousands, going south from Khan Yunis.
Well, Amy, I'm sure you saw the response, and the response was a typical American administration word salad. And the reason that I think it's so important for us to continue to press ahead is because what Israel has had in mind is two things since the beginning of this attack on Gaza. First, it has made it clear that it wants to make Gaza smaller in size. And they've made it clear that they want to, quote, thin out the population. So it's the combination of genocide and ethnic cleansing and taking more Palestinian land. And that's why from the beginning, it was clear to anybody who was paying attention that Israel was going to begin in the north, but then suddenly magically move to the south as everybody had looked the other way. And this is precisely what's happening. So now what Israel is doing is not only just dropping leaflets in Khan Yunis, there isn't a single place that has been safe in Gaza from day one. And the intention is clear. If you want to get medical treatment, even now or a day after the bombing ends, you're going to have to seek it elsewhere. If you want to get education, you're going to have to go elsewhere. If you want to have a home and have a normal life, you're going to have to go elsewhere. And so it's this combination of genocide and ethnic cleansing that Israel has been pushing forward from day one. And the problem is, of course, that the United States has been not only an enabler for Israel, but it's been blocking any other effort to try to stop this process of genocide and ethnic cleansing.
And the issue of this court decision, we just have 10 seconds, going to the UN Security Council if violated.
Yes. So under the rules of the International Court of Justice, states must oblige, they're obliged to uphold the rules of the ICJ, the decisions. But if they do not, they can go to the UN Security Council. And so I suspect that we will be seeing this at the Security Council. The real question is whether the United States is going to use that veto or abstain.
We want to thank you all for being with us today. Diana Bhutu, Palestinian human rights attorney, former advisor to the negotiating team of the Palestine Liberation Organization. In 2004, she was part of the legal team that won a case before the International Court of Justice, which ruled Israel's separation wall in the West Bank is illegal under international law. Speaking to us from Haifa, Israel. And Mahmoud Mamdani, professor of government at Columbia University. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
I think the question that civic movements across the Arab world are asking is, where is the ceiling here? Is there any point at which these governments are going to start actually taking real action? So while governments may be unwilling to go further in jeopardizing what they see as their own interests, they are going to face mounting pressure from civil society, which really does want to see action taken at this point.
From Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, I am Yara Hawari, and this is Rethinking Palestine. The genocide in Gaza, which began in October 2023, is ongoing. Nearly the entire population has been displaced from their homes, with the majority forced into tiny areas in the south near the Rafah border with Egypt. Upwards of 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, and a third of whom are children. Many more are trapped under the rubble of their bombed homes. In the Arab world, demonstrations have taken place in Jordan, Bahrain, Yemen, Lebanon, and beyond, against this brutal assault and in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Yet by and large, these demonstrations and the popular sentiment have not been represented in the form of action from their governments. Indeed, there is a very stark disconnect between the popular Arab support for Palestinian liberation and the action or inaction of the Arab regimes and leaders. To discuss this more, I'm joined by Dr. Ilham Fakhro. Ilham is a research fellow at the Institute of Arab and Islamic Studies at Exeter University, and an associate fellow at the Chatham House MENA program. She's the author of an upcoming book on the Abraham Accords and Arab normalization with Israel. Ilham, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you, Yara. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So Ilham, obviously this is a huge topic and we can't homogenize the region into a one size fits all, but I think it would be good to try and cover as much as possible and to get an overview. So with that in mind, perhaps you can start off by giving us a summary of what the reaction to the genocide in Gaza has been amongst peoples across the region.
Absolutely. So there's been massive support for the Palestinians across the entire region. And I think that's quantifiable in three ways, actually. We've seen popular protests taking place across the Arab world, particularly, as you noted, in the countries where protests are more or less allowed. The numbers that we've seen coming out onto the streets in places like Jordan, Egypt, even Morocco, Yemen, haven't really been seen since, I would say, the Iraq War protests shook the region in 2003 and during the Second Intifada. So there's huge popular mass support for the Palestinians in Arab cities. We've also seen a revival of the boycott movement, a lot of support for BDS right now, particularly targeting the brands that support occupation, that support the settlements in particular. We've seen Starbucks targeted, McDonald's, even lesser known brands like Caribou Coffee. People do their research. Caribou, for example, operates in the settlements and people have targeted them as a result. So it's a really expansive boycott movement. Even Joe and the Juice, you know, which is not a usual target for these movements, has also been targeted for boycott in places like Bahrain. So people on social media are really raising awareness of this. They're educating themselves when access to this information just isn't available on usual media networks and on the mainstream media. And we're also seeing evidence of this support just in polling data that's been coming out in the past few weeks. So, for example, a recent poll from the Washington Institute in Washington, D.C. found that 96% of Saudis now oppose normalization with Israel. This is a jump from previous numbers. Another released from the Doha Institute found that 97% of Arabs experience psychological stress from the conflict in Gaza. People are deeply, deeply affected by the devastation and the genocide that they're seeing play out on a day-to-day basis. And I think it's interesting. I mean, I'll just anecdotally point out in my own experience, social media is flooded with images from Gaza, and it has been every single day for the past 3 months. People aren't letting up. You might expect there to be fatigue at this point, but there isn't. People are determined to keep awareness going and to keep pressure going as much as they can.
This popular sentiment that you've outlined for us stands in direct contrast to many of the Arab regimes and their governments who've largely been inactive. Can you tell us why this is the case and perhaps give us a few examples?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Arab states have been active merely at the level of rhetoric. They've come together, you know, during several, well, the Saudi-led summit in particular at the beginning of the war, to call for a ceasefire. They've called for eventually a return to talks around a two-state solution and for greater humanitarian aid to enter Gaza. These are the three points around which they are united. But this rhetoric really hasn't translated into any kind of meaningful action. Jordan is really the only country that has even recalled its ambassador to Israel. The other Arab states that have ambassadors haven't even gone so far as to do that. It's really a far cry when you think about the past action that's been taken at the level of, for example, the 1973 oil embargo. Arab states have been very, very timid this time around. It's clear that they're placing their own interests above the Palestinian issue. It's clear that they aren't really attentive or willing to respond to populist and popular pressures to do something about this, or at least to cut or downgrade diplomatic relations. And that's what we're seeing across the board.
Ilham, you are largely based in Bahrain. Could you tell us about what's been going on there and the protests there?
Yeah, so Bahrain has been one of the most active places on this, despite it being, you know, very small and having a smaller population relative to the rest of the Arab world. But in Bahrain, we've seen weekly protests every single Friday in support of the Palestinians. And these take two forms. There are official protests, I mean, licensed protests that are sanctioned by the government, allowed by the government. These are usually led by a society called the Bahrain Society Against Normalization with the Zionist Enemy. This was a civil society group established in 2002 during the Second Intifada to really resist any kind of normalization with Israel, whether through trade, whether through official diplomatic relations or anything like that. So this society has been organizing weekly protests. And to some extent, you know, the state tolerates it, they allow it. But I think I do have to add a caveat there that it's within carefully confined areas. So the licenses that are given for these protests are either within a closed off courtyard in Manama. This is away from public view, or they take place outside the capital, again, outside the main highways. So this is really where we see what the government is willing to tolerate in terms of public visible dissent. There are also plenty of unauthorized protests that take place. These are organized by other political groups. Some of them have been banned in connection with the Arab Spring protests. So these organizations and groups also do organize protests. These take place usually in villages, also away from public view. And these are the ones that are more likely or are subjected to a crackdown. So people found protesting in these demonstrations have been the target of arrest. And Human Rights Watch has recently issued a report outlining the arrest of children at some of these demonstrations under the age of 18.
And why is it that Bahraini authorities allow some protests to take place and not others?
It's a great question, Yara. I think they are aware that completely banning protests around this issue would be a step too far. They, I think, are conscious that people feel very, very strongly around this issue. Perhaps there is an awareness that there needs to be some kind of release for the pressures that people face. So they do allow these protests, but I think we do need to recognize as well that that's unlikely to have an impact on public policy in the state. It's more of a sense of, okay, let the people sort of release some of the frustrations and anger that they feel around this issue. We'll allow it to take place away from public view. You know, none of the kind of tourists visiting the country, none of the embassy officials are going to really see any of this unless they go and look for it. None of the journalists, certainly. And so in this way, they're able to sort of balance between popular pressure and their own policy of maintaining relations with Israel.
And that's the strategy that we've seen elsewhere as well, where authorities allow for demonstrations or protests as a way to sort of release or as a release for popular outrage against the genocide. We've certainly seen that in Jordan. And you mentioned earlier that Jordan was the only regime which has relations with Israel that actually took action and dispelled its or expelled its Israeli ambassador. And I think Jordan's been an interesting one to follow. They obviously have to play a very delicate balancing act between their domestic and foreign considerations. The majority of the population have Palestinian backgrounds, and Jordan has seen massive protests in support of Gaza and the Palestinian struggle. And meanwhile, the Jordanian regime has a very strong relationship with the US. It's actually the second largest recipient of US aid after Israel. And so many in Jordan are actually calling for the government to do more, to actually totally cut diplomatic ties with the Israeli regime. And it's worth noting that they did endorse South Africa's ICJ genocide submission. But do you think this is as far as they will go?
We are waiting to see where the red lines are for the Arab governments. What amount of dead Palestinians are going to spur further action from them? It wasn't 10,000, it wasn't 20,000, and it isn't 30,000. So I think the question that civic movements across the Arab world are asking is, where is the ceiling here? Is there any point at which these governments are going to start actually taking real action? For Jordan, as you noted, it's very, very dependent on the United States. So is a country like Bahrain. And so governments for now are choosing to prioritize those relationships, but it is impacting civic perceptions on the ground. I mean, opposition and anger towards not only Israel, but the United States is at an all-time high right now. Even polling data reflects this. I think the earlier poll that I referenced from the Doha Institute found that 70% of Arabs, this is a poll from 16 countries, experience or are articulating anger towards the United States as well. So while governments may be unwilling to take action or go further in jeopardizing what they see as their own interests, they are going to face mounting pressure from civil society, which really does want to see action taken at this point.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work. A lot of these regimes are incredibly worried about civil unrest and how this spill over into criticizing domestic policy, because I think Arabs across the region are realizing that the Palestinian struggle is directly linked to their liberation from authoritarian regimes.
This is where we see the two issues as related. Arab governments have not been responsive on the Palestinian issue, but this also kind of brings back memories or existing grievances for Arab populations on their own local demands, which is why we do see the two issues linked in the popular consciousness, I think, for many people.
So, of course, over the last few years, policy vis-a-vis the Israeli regime in the region has been characterized by the Abraham Accords, which you have extensively written about. These accords ushered in this new and, quite frankly, frightening era for the Middle East, where diplomatic relations with the Israeli regime grants all kinds of privileges, including weaponry from the US. Now, prior to October 2023, Saudi Arabia was actually poised to be next in line to normalize, and it seemed like negotiations were speeding along. What happened there, and what's likely to happen in the coming years, particularly noting that you mentioned that polling data where 96% of Saudis now oppose normalization?
Right. So the issue of Saudi normalization is a very interesting one, because most of what we do hear about this comes from U.S. sources and it comes from Israeli sources. And I think Israeli sources in particular have always wanted to make it seem like the Arab states are on the cusp of normalization, that they're just about to or that they want to in this case, and that they're willing to do it cost free. Now, this was the case for the UAE and Bahrain and largely Morocco and Sudan, who entered these accords without really ensuring anything for the Palestinians. It was cost-free in that sense. But Saudi, for its part, has at least at the formal level maintained a commitment to a two-state solution and maintained its commitment to something for the Palestinians, even if that might fall short. Now, of course, there are differences between what a country sometimes declares as its formal policy and what it's willing to do, in fact, and what it's negotiating behind the scenes. But I think it is notable that Saudi Arabia hasn't yet backed down from this. And whenever asked by media sources, Saudi officials repeat the same thing. I mean, it's been the case since the start of these talks. Whenever they're asked this question, the answer is always the same. It's that we won't normalize without progress on the Palestinian issue or something akin to a two-state solution. And I think this is significant because it does show that as much as there's a lack of sort of clarity around this, there is still some level of commitment to Saudi achieving something for the Palestinians. It's not exactly the way Israeli media and Israeli officials portray it, which is that Saudi is ready to sign tomorrow. I think on the other side of it, there are also questions around U.S. commitments. I mean, Saudi Arabia has asked for a lot in return for normalization. They've asked for nuclear know-how. They've asked for advanced missile technology. And they've asked for something akin to U.S. security pact from the United States. Whether the U.S. is prepared to deliver all of these things to Saudi in exchange for normalization is another open question. So I think even before October 7th, there were a lot of real gray areas around whether Saudi was prepared to go ahead and really go the full route. I think it's worth pointing out that Saudi also has a lot to lose if that's the case. It does risk its kind of moral authority as the leader of the Arab and Islamic world. There's a possibility that, of course, relations with Israel would inflame its existing tensions or its relationship with Iran. Saudi has been committed to de-escalating with Iran, most notably in the past year. So I don't think they want to see that be reversed through a new relationship with Israel. So where I'm getting at is Saudi has a lot to think about. It's not that straightforward. It's not that clear cut. And I don't think a deal was really as imminent as Israeli and Western officials made it seem. Now, post October 7th, I think it's even less likely. I think Saudi Arabia has to be conscious, and it is conscious of popular sentiments, not just within the kingdom around this, but within the broader Arab and Islamic world. And so this is definitely one area where we do see an impact on an Arab government, where the Gaza war has impacted the decision-making of an Arab government.
One of the things that I've read that, or I've seen Saudi officials doing, is sort of framing normalization as strategic, not only for Saudi Arabia itself, but also for the Palestinian people. So they sort of frame it as a mechanism for leverage to achieve Palestinian rights or to move closer to a Palestinian state.
I don't think it works if you come into this and say, okay, we're going to establish the relationship and then later we're going to use it as some kind of leverage, or later we're going to use it to secure something for the Palestinians. That clearly doesn't work.
Ilham, I want to move us along because we haven't talked about Egypt yet. And Egypt plays quite a significant role. Not only has it normalized diplomatic relations with Israel several decades ago, but it's also complicit in the siege of Gaza through the Rafah border. Now, we've seen some mobilization in Egypt, noting, of course, that it's an incredibly repressive environment for political protest. But we've also seen on a diplomatic level a lot of pressure placed on Egypt by the US and by Israel. And there have been rumors that Egypt will be forced by the US and Israel to rehouse, forcibly expel Palestinians from Gaza in the Sinai. Now, Egyptian President Sisi has denied these rumors, not out of love for Palestinians, but rather because he has his own security concerns in the Sinai. What do you think about Egypt's role in all of this? And do you think that the level of outrage of the Egyptian people could have some kind of influence on government policy?
Again, like all other Arab countries, we haven't seen that happen yet. And it's not clear where the threshold lies. Egypt has, you know, been under pressure, certainly, so has Jordan, to open its borders and rehouse, as you say, or voluntarily resettle, as the Israelis say, the Palestinians. It has not been willing to do that yet. Again, it's not clear if that changes down the line, but so far that's the case. And it, again, Egypt's official position towards Israel really hasn't budged in spite of populist pressures on it to do so.
So perhaps we can turn finally to Yemen. Now, Yemen has historically been a big supporter of Palestine. The Yemeni people have been hitting the streets over the last few months in their hundreds of thousands. And Yemen has also taken direct action in opposition to the genocide in Gaza by disrupting the shipping lanes in the Red Sea. A lot of people in Palestine obviously feel like this is the kind of thing that other Arab regimes should be doing, disrupting and really, you know, making the world pay a price for their complicity in the genocide. How is this action that Yemen has taken seen across the region?
Yemen's action has been pretty extraordinary. It's one of the poorest Arab states. We all know that the conflict has been going on since 2015. It's in a dire humanitarian condition, and yet the Houthis have been able to pretty successfully impose a blockade on Israel, which no other Arab government or country has been willing to do. As a result of that, we have seen a lot of support for the Houthis from across the Arab world. Their popularity has, of course, risen. So has Hamas's popularity. I mean, one of the polls I cited earlier, the one by the Washington Institute, in fact, found a four-fold increase in support for Hamas within Saudi Arabia. And, you know, I'm sorry for emphasizing the Gulf states a bit too much, but that's the area that I usually cover. And so this is one area that people have been, I think, positively moved by. It's seen in the context of sort of global solidarity for the Palestinians. Also, what we've seen with South Africa bringing the case to the ICJ, Namibia supporting that, Bangladesh supporting that. And so I think there is this fascinating sort of emergence of the global South as a point of solidarity for the Palestinians beyond just the Houthis in Yemen. And I think the US-UK-led bombardment of Yemen in response is very telling and really reinforces perceptions. This is Western support for a settler colonial state facing resistance not only from the Palestinians, but from the Arab masses and elements of the global South.
Thank you, Ilham. And I think this is really, you know, a turning point in the region. I think there's no going back from this. I think what people are increasingly realizing from Jordan to Bahrain to Yemen is that the Palestinian struggle for liberation is inherently tied to their own liberation. Support from the US in countries such as Jordan and in many of the Gulf states is really only benefiting a very small minority of the population, you know, the elites. And so people are recognizing that the situations that they're in, the hardships that they're facing, the authoritarianism that they face is ultimately tied to the Palestinian people, to the Palestinian people's struggle. And this is something that I think a lot of the Arab regimes are worried about, that this will spill over and cause instability domestically, because for so long, these regimes have really tried to isolate Palestine, to make the Palestinian struggles this sort of single issue cause, or to use it really as a political pawn. And people are, I think, refusing that understanding of Palestine and what the struggle for liberation means.
Absolutely. I think this is circling back to the issue of a lack of representation in the Arab world. This is really tying everything together. And I think if you look at Bahrain, it's a very good example. I mean, people are out on the streets, they're protesting the war in Gaza, they're protesting the U.S. base, but they're also asking questions around their own government's policy, which they were not consulted in. Why is Bahrain participating in the naval effort to patrol the Red Sea? Nobody has been consulted on this issue. And so, yeah, what we're seeing in Gaza very much ties into right now the lack of representation across the Arab world.
Okay, Ilham, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine. We'll leave it there, but we hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you, Yara. It was great to join you.
Rethinking Palestine is brought to you by Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Ashabaka is the only global independent Palestinian think tank whose mission is to produce critical policy analysis and collectively imagine a new policy-making paradigm for Palestine and Palestinians worldwide. For more information or to donate to support our work, visit al-shabaka.org. And importantly, don't forget to subscribe to Rethinking Palestine wherever you listen to podcasts.
We get to the conclusion that freedom of expression for a group is the expression of themselves. For Jewish Israelis, is eventually the expression of themselves within the state. As for Palestinians, the limits of freedom of expression are the tools of control that the state uses, practices, and through it oppresses voices of Palestinians. And as we know today, in academia, in workplaces, in activism, and anywhere.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Butu. In the aftermath of October the 7th, Palestinian students in Israeli higher education institutions soon came under attack for social media posts. These attacks, which were coordinated between Israeli government officials, Israeli institutions, and far-right groups, targeted students expressing dissent against Israel's attacks on Gaza and led to the expulsion or suspension of students for alleged violations of the university's codes of conduct. In other cases, students faced criminal charges, while others were attacked, and some of them physically, in their dorms. It's important to note that all of these measures were taken while the universities were out of session, in fact, before the semester had begun, and for social media posts, so nothing in relation to activity on campus. Some of the so-called offensive posts involved students liking or sharing a social media post, in some cases for providing context to October 7th's events, or for expressing solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. In some cases, students posted calls to end Israel's attacks, while some were completely unrelated, for example, for posting verses from the Quran. In most of these cases, those who reported the posts were fellow students. And the repressive measures didn't just stop there. In some cases, the universities then forwarded the information to the Israel police, with students being arrested for their social media posts. To hear more about this, I spoke to Hadi Mansour, who is a lawyer at Adala, the civil rights organization for Palestinians inside Israel. We tried to speak to a student, but all of the students are too afraid to speak out, given the climate of fear. Now, Adala has represented over 120 students against whom disciplinary measures have been imposed, but there are hundreds of others. He speaks to us about the measures imposed against these students, about the coordinated campaign against students, and about why this is happening. We also hear about what the universities have done, or actually not done, to address genocidal speech against Palestinians. Thank you for listening. In the aftermath of the 7th of October, we heard a lot about students who were getting disciplined from university. Of course, not for anything that they did on campus, because the campuses hadn't opened up, they still hadn't returned back to school. Can you talk a little bit about what happened and what the university's response was and what has happened to these students?
We see that different state actors, but also sub-state actors, such as universities and colleges, have joined and collaborated in a crackdown on Palestinian citizens of Israel. Generally speaking, whenever there's some kind of emergency situation or some kind of war, specifically born on Palestinians, we see that the state, with all its actors, face and work in order to prevent Palestinians from expressing themselves and gaining more control on their day-to-day life. Now, within that, we saw that colleges and universities have decided to start disciplinary procedures against Palestinian students on social media posts that, in their understanding, are either against the state or supporting the enemy or supporting or sympathizing with declared terrorist organizations. When we say declared terrorist organizations, we mean organizations that were declared within the Israeli law as such. However, what we saw and what we faced within this are arbitrary processes that looked at Palestinian citizens of Israel as enemies and proceeded in procedures without even acknowledging their background and without understanding or comprehending the language or even their religious beliefs and so on. And what I mean by that is that we had procedures that vary from posting quotes from the Quran to people who are posting support to Palestinians in Gaza, to people who are trying to raise awareness on the war crimes that are happening in Gaza, and to different posts that were posted on the 7th and on the 8th that, in our legal opinion, fall within the limits and the protection of freedom of expression, at least as it should be. And what I mean as it should be is that within the Israeli legal system, there is a clear distinction between how the law is practiced against Palestinians to how the law is practiced against Jewish Israelis, specifically concerning freedom of expression.
I suspect that some of the people who were reporting these posts may not necessarily have been the police. Do you have any indication of who was reporting these posts?
A lot of right-wing activists and a lot of right-wing factions within the universities and colleges have joined hands in order to report these students and act against these students in any possible way. These students and activists have reported these students, the Palestinian students, to their universities and colleges. They have reported them to the police. They have acted in many ways also through activism in order to suspend and prevent these students from going back to their studies. And sadly, academic institutions have given a green light to these processes. And therefore, what we've seen, what we are actually living until now, is an act of systematic revenge that has joined hands between extreme right-wing activists and students and the institutions themselves.
To make it sound maybe too simplistic, it sounds as though the students who were in their study groups were the ones who were reporting that. Am I being too simplistic?
It's exactly that. And some people who were following them on Instagram or on Facebook and so on decided to take a screenshot and send it and post it. And sadly, we go into disciplinary procedures where the prosecutor within the university or within the college. So what's interesting about this process is that they are very similar to court, right? So you have a prosecutor who brings materials and so on, and they have to prove that this post or this content violates the laws and the procedures of the university or the college. Now, what we've seen is that the institutions themselves, they didn't double check. And in a lot of instances, we had very wrong, inaccurate translations that in a lot of instances were translated specifically in order to indict the people, specifically in order to lead to the suspension of the studies of the student and so on. You cannot suspend students based on assumption that this post violates the laws of the university and the colleges, which, by the way, we argue that they have no authority on.
What is it that the school could do to these students? What are all of the levels of disciplinary measures that students can face?
The punishments when it comes to this matter vary from temporary suspension to suspension altogether from studies in the institution, but they could also be educational punishments, and such as having a group to talk about what's going on, or that the students have to do some kind of service in the university or the college. And we've seen that as punishments in different institutions. But whenever we go in the prospect of punishments, so it's important to say that almost half of the cases that we represent them, we succeeded in canceling the procedure. And students did go back to their studies. But in cases that the students were eventually indicted with the criminal charges, we saw a lot of punishments of suspension from studies. And if we try to dig a little bit deeper and understand the meaning of this, specifically when we're talking about charges of supporting terrorism or supporting the enemy and so on, we understand that the academia in itself differentiates between an enemy and a friend. That the academia has decided to go out of the boundaries that it set for itself for academic freedom and freedom of expression to a place where it judges, decides, and facilitates an institution which is based on supremacy, which is based on racism, and specifically which is based on an assumption that Palestinians eventually are the enemy and they have to prove otherwise.
And imagine that it also impacts students beyond, because if you look at a student's transcript and they are, for example, suspended, let's say if you want to go into another degree, a master's or a PhD, that obviously is going to be on your transcript, and I don't think you can just do away with it, can you?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the major punishments that we are really concerned about, is that the effect is not only on the matter right now, or not only in the specific institution, but we're talking about the future of the students. We're talking about people who decided to go into academia, and specifically when we're talking about Palestinian citizens of Israel, academia and studies are one of the major tools, not only for to succeed in life, but also as a form or as a tool for an oppressed minority to build itself collectively and try continuously to challenge the inequality that they live in. And for years now, ever since the Nakba, we see that acquiring degrees and education is one of the major challenges, but also the major prospects or the major aspirations of Palestinian citizens of Israel. When we look generation-wise, we see that it became one of the major or the most prominent acts that Palestinian citizens of Israel go into, because eventually they have no other thing. They don't have any grip in power. They don't have any effect on decision-making process. They have no ability to build themselves collectively and fight for their freedom and equality, since the state oppresses and prevents a lot of political activism. Therefore, education, but also political activism within education and within academic institutions for years has been one of the major, and the effect of not only on the students themselves, but on the dynamics within the academia. When we look at surveys today, we see that the majority of students are afraid. They're either afraid and terrified from facing another procedure such as their fellow students, but they also feel, the majority of them feel that they are monitored, that everyone is watching what they are writing and what they are publishing. And the majority of them feel incitement against them. And this has a major effect on the way we perceive education as Palestinians. So therefore, the effect is double. It's also on the individual level for students who aspire for education and higher education, also for master's and PhD, but also in our understanding of education as a political tool for Palestinians.
I think it's important to keep in mind that in the aftermath of the Nakba, this was a community that had been completely and totally devastated. It's not as though there were institutions that remained and that we were able to go into these institutions. We had to build these institutions from the ground up. And as you said, one of the ways in which this was done was by having a vibrant education system. In other words, Palestinians have been educated despite Israel, not because of Israel. We built ourselves up despite Israel rather than because of Israel. Israel hasn't done any favors to us. And so it sounds as what you're saying is that this is actually one of the goals, is to try to bring down this community, to weaken them so that they can weaken not only their educational prospects, but their future prospects in terms of politics and having a voice in this country.
Absolutely. As you've mentioned, we're talking about a community that remained with nothing, talking about a community that remained under military rule for around 20 years after the Nakba, which any political activism within the military rule was prevented. And eventually, what we see in the last couple of years is that the ideology concerning education of Palestinians has shifted to a place where academic institutions illustrate themselves as supporting the education of Palestinians, basically having very specific programs for Palestinian citizens of Israel, supporting having some kind of a nest for people who come with no background in the Hebrew language. And of course, this is one of the major challenges for Palestinians and in Israeli institutions, since everything is taught in Hebrew. And what we see now is that there is a very clear neglect to this idea But there's also clarity in this idea. Because what we see now is that these institutions are declaring, yes, we want Palestinians in our institutions, but we want them in a very specific way. We want Palestinians to be in the institutions not as Palestinians, but as individuals who are afraid to express their national identity, who would do anything to fight for their education. And if we put boundaries on how they receive education, we put boundaries on their political participation and representation.
We're not just talking about disciplinary measures against students. Of course, there have been measures taken against people in their jobs. Sometimes no measures, just simply fired from their employment. But I wonder if you can speak a little bit to how it is that people are feeling now, because this isn't just a one-time event. We're now over 3 months, over 100 days into the Israeli attack on Gaza. So in between facing these disciplinary measures, they're also watching what Israel is doing. Can you talk a little bit about how people are feeling?
Since the war started, we're talking about more than 150 disciplinary procedures in universities and colleges. 34 academic institutions have started disciplinary procedures against their students. Criminal cases, we're talking about hundreds of investigations and arrests and more than 100 criminal charges for posting content on social media. Now, these are very big numbers. If we compare, just to compare, we managed to obtain some information on cases of incitement, limiting freedom of expression between 2018 until 2021, including the Dignity Uprising. During 3 years, okay, 3 years, we're talking about 56 criminal charges, 50 of them against Palestinians. So generally speaking, the approach is a racist understanding of the law, which applies differently to Palestinians. Almost 90% of cases until 2021 were against Palestinians. In 3 months, we're talking about more than double. The crackdown of the institutions, and not to mention the prevention of any protest against the war and prevention of any organization of activities. There were attempts which eventually succeeded by the police to prevent meetings, to prevent protests, to prevent demonstrations and so on against the war. These all send messages to the people, not only what you're not allowed to say, but what you should say, and more than that, what you should think. If you're not supporting Israel in the war, you are the enemy. Now you decide, do you want to be the enemy or not? Eventually, you can be passive and not express your opinion. This affects directly your ability to critically think about reality. And to top that, Israel came with the proposition or with a new law that criminalizes the consumption of specific materials, which they declare as materials that concern a terrorist organization. If we look a little bit specifically at academic institutions, students are terrified to go back to their studies because in a lot of places, there are protests against them to prevent them from going back. We're talking about protests that are being organized by student unions in some universities, as for example, Haifa University, where the same body that is supposed to protect these students and represent them is demanding their suspension.
My last question. Just last week, we saw the ICJ hearing. And in the South African submission before the ICJ, there were 9 full pages of statements of incitement against Palestinians by high-level leaders, by people in the army, etc. I imagine that there's also statements by Israeli students against Palestinian students, because those things they're never insular. Have you seen that Israeli students have been facing similar disciplinary measures?
There have been 0 charges or processes against any person who incited or supported the war crimes that are still unfolding in Gaza. Until now, in all the processes that we represented in, and despite that in our representation, we pointed out to the incitement that's happening on social media. We didn't see even one case where a student faced charges for supporting criminal acts and supporting war crimes and supporting and inciting for genocide in Gaza, it's worth mentioning that one of our main arguments in front of academic institutions is that they have no authority. The law specifically describes what kind of disciplinary procedures and rules can institution have regarding students. And the law states very specifically that any kind of disciplinary rules are supposed to have a connection to the student being a student, meaning that you cannot enforce your disciplinary rules on your students when they are acting within their personal sphere. And I have to say, this is not really surprising, because this is what the state is doing. So the state is in a form of doing. It's in a form of acting upon the same ideas that these people are saying. And therefore, and when we understand that the limits of freedom of expression are inherently connected to how the society that formulates the state perceives what is right and what is wrong, we get to the result and to the conclusion that this illusion of democracy for Palestinian citizens of Israel is very much connected to the systematic racism and colonial approach to Palestinians, citizens of Israel. We get to the conclusion that freedom of expression for a group is the expression of themselves. For Jewish Israelis, is eventually the expression of themselves within the state. As for Palestinians, the limits of freedom of expression are the tools of control that the state uses, practices, and through it oppresses voices of Palestinians. And as we know today, in academia, in workplaces, in activism, and anywhere where a Palestinian might face an Israeli in this country.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine. Thank you.
What's going on, y'all? It's your girl, Miss Ben, and it's Black History Month, so you know we'll be kicking it every Tuesday right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Every Tuesday from 3 to 5, I bring to you Heal, Black Girl Heal, where we discuss some in-depth conversations with those that got some things going on within the Black community. And let's not forget about all of the plentiful activities that you need to keep up to date with. So do not forget, each and every Tuesday for the month of February, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
This is the Amanda Galas. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.